Finally, Dr. Goldberg comments on the other topics discussed in the think tank, beginning with Dr. Haller's topic of the use of oxaliplatin in neoadjuvant therapy of rectal cancer.
There was an analysis that looked at patients getting singlets or doublets in terms of the frequency of complete pathologic response rates. And this was an analysis that looked at rectal cancer trials and then pulled out a subset of those that met certain criteria. What it showed was that there was a higher likelihood of response as long as you gave doses of radiation that were adequate, meaning above 40 gray. And there also was a higher likelihood of complete response if you used two drugs rather than one. Now, having said that, I was actually a bit surprised by the frequency with which people were adding oxaliplatin to treatment in rectal cancer, because I still believe that the standard of care is either FOLFOX or capecitabine rather than adding any other drug to that, whether that drug is cetuximab or bevacizumab or oxaliplatin or irinotecan.
When you say FOLFOX, you mean as part of neoadjuvant therapy?
Yes, people were using oxaliplatin plus 5-FU as part of neoadjuvant therapy with radiation.
But was it specifically the FOLFOX regimen?
No, it wasn't. It was generally infusional 5-FU with about 60 milligrams per meter squared weekly of oxaliplatin, as was described in a paper by David Ryan published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
Is that something you are doing in your own practice outside of protocol setting?
You know, we participated in the CLGB trial that culminated in the Ryan paper, and I had some gratifying responses with oxali added to 5-FU, but I don't use it outside of the context of a clinical trial.
I guess the situation a lot of people talk about is the younger patient with a pretty locally advanced tumor, maybe even a situation where sphincter sparing, you know, sort of borderline, that still wouldn't get you to do it, huh?
Well, it's hard to say.
But you haven't done it yet.
I haven't done it yet.
Another topic that raised a lot of discussion was Alan Vanuk's discussion of the issue of arterial events and bevacizumab. First of all, what's your overall take on that, and what do you say to patients in counseling them about it?
Well, I do tell them that there's an increased risk of an arterial event, and to them, arterial event doesn't really mean anything, so you have to really talk about heart attack or angina pains or a stroke. It seems to be a relatively low risk in people under the age of 65 and in people who've not had a prior history of any of those sorts of illnesses. However, if somebody has had a recent arterial event, their risk can be as high as 17 to 20%, it looks like, for an arterial thrombotic event. Now, of course, these are catastrophes. In many cases, when they happen, they often aren't small lacuna infarcts. They're infarcts that have substantial ongoing health ramifications. Having said that, I was one of the people that voted in favor of considering the use of the bevacizumab even in people with an increased risk as long as you informed them of that risk.
I was kind of surprised, too, because I figured a lot more people would do that. And when you say that, you're saying even within the last 6 months?
Yes, that's true. I've had several older patients that have had history of lacuna infarct and who collectively we made a decision to go ahead and use bevacizumab.
What kind of situations? I guess one thing I could envision is someone who's having symptoms from metastatic disease.
Right.
Is that the main time that you're thinking about this, or some type of life-threatening problem?
Or if they have obviously bulky disease or aggressive disease.
Right. Another related topic that came out was the issue of treatment of hypertension, and there were a couple of papers presented on this topic at the meeting. What's your approach in your own practice in terms of the bar that you use to treat hypertension? At what systolic and diastolic blood pressure will you start treating?
Well, I mainly look at the diastolic, and if it gets above 90 at all, I'm pretty aggressive about getting patients started either on an ACE inhibitor or a beta blocker. I don't tend to use diuretics in this circumstance. You know, there's always the worry that the patient's got hypertension only because they are in your oncology office in a stressful circumstance. I know that Dan Haller mentioned at the meeting that he requires all of his patients to buy blood pressure cuffs. He treats a different demographic than I do, and some of my patients would find that a financial burden, so I haven't done that in my practice.
When you treat hypertension, is it with the same kind of thinking as the treatment of hypertension in a person without cancer, or are you in some way more worried that there'll be more complications from hypertension with Bev?
I essentially follow the same sort of thing I would do for general internal medicine practice.
Is there any indication that, for example, the lack of treatment or not as aggressive a treatment is associated with any particular problem?
I'm not certain that anybody has done that, but I would think that the Bright Registry will probably send in an ASCO abstract on that very subject.
Right. Another topic that there was a lot of discussion on had to do with the issue of the patient presenting with a primary in place with metastatic disease, and also the NSABP study looking at FOLFOX and Avastin in those patients. What's your own approach to patients with colon and rectal cancer when they have metastatic disease?
When I have patients with metastatic disease at presentation, I try not to resect them. And I follow that strategy for a couple of reasons. One is that in most cases, when I've done that, they haven't had complications. There actually was a paper that came out of David Cunningham's group at the Royal Marsden several years ago, in which they looked at all patients entered on clinical trials at the Royal Marsden and divided them into those patients that had their primaries in place and those who had had their primaries resected. And they didn't observe any higher rate of bleeding complications, need for blood transfusions, or obstruction in the unresected patients as they'd seen in their resected patients. There are some times that rectal cancer patients will be nearly obstructed and need to either have a resection or to have local regional therapy with radiation, or in some cases a colostomy.
I guess it's particularly scary to leave a rectal cancer alone because, you know, we're all so sensitized to the fact that when this gets out of control, it's really a horrible situation.
It certainly can be with local growth into sacral plexus and debility because of both incontinence and pain.
Although, you know, when you look at what the natural history of metastatic disease is, and particularly if it's not controlled, looking at fairly rapid change, going downhill course there.
Well, one of the other things that's been kind of fun as CAT scanners have gotten better is that you now can often see the primary on the CAT scan, even for non-pelvic tumors. And it's been entertaining to watch the correlation in patients who have some symptoms of obstruction as they get treated and respond. They'll come into you and tell you that their symptoms are decreasing and you can actually see the primaries decrease in size on the CTs.
That's interesting. Do you have the experience of seeing many primaries respond to systemic therapy?
I certainly have, yeah.
Any overall impression in terms of whether it's more or less responsive than the average Met?
I don't know that I have a big enough N to really judge, but I would say that a vast majority of the primaries that I've followed have gotten smaller with chemotherapy.
I guess the strategy in breast cancer in this kind of a situation, which is not very common, is to just consider the primary as one of the lesions that has to be palliated. And if it's not causing an immediate problem, just as if, you know, lung or bone met's not causing an immediate symptomatic problem, to just treat the patient systemically. Do you think that sort of is a strategy that makes sense here?
Yeah, I think that's a very sensible way of looking at it.
The other discussion I wanted to ask you about was Howard Hoekstra's talk about systemic therapy for the patient with potentially curable metastatic disease and the question of, do you go all out and use chemotherapy plus double antibody therapy? What were your thoughts about that?
Well, again, there isn't a lot of data out there on the use of double antibody therapy, and the CLGB trial 80405 is looking at that. It's dealer's choice, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with either cetuximab, bevacizumab, or both. And then the PACE trial, which is completed accrual, looked at panitumumab plus bevacizumab with chemotherapy or bevacizumab alone. We don't have response data really on any of those studies or progression-free survival or overall survival data. You could make an argument for pulling out all the stops. Another approach that you could use in this circumstance would be the FOLFOX-IRI approach that's being used in Europe. In Europe, it often is not possible to use the monoclonal antibodies because of the cost of drugs there. And in that circumstance, using three chemo drugs rather than two chemo drugs and two antibodies might be the preferred approach. I have not yet used FOLFOX-IRI in my practice. You know, I think that the results that are being seen are similar to the results seen with bevacizumab, and I have to admit that I'm a little daunted by the prospect of the toxicity.
You know, one of the things that I was kind of confused coming out of the meeting is this issue of, quote, using systemic therapy to make patients, quote, curable for surgery. And yet, you know, we had this discussion about the fact that even when you sterilize a tumor clinically in terms of imaging, that, you know, there are going to be tumor cells there. And then the question of sort of having the tumor get pulled back a little bit so the surgery can be done. Can you talk about your take on all that?
Well, I do think that that's important. You know, there are times when the bile ducts and the hepatic vasculature become the limiting margins in terms of what can and can't be resected. If something is very central in the liver, you may not be able to leave an adequate hepatic remnant and get a good enough margin to permit a good cancer operation. And so if you can shrink the tumor back away from those vascular structures, you may have a better outcome. And that technique has certainly been best exploited by the group at the Hospital Paul Broussais in France, led by Bismuth and Adam, who have these amazing pictures that they show of patients with softballs in their liver that shrink down to golf balls and then are resected.
Have you done that yourself in your own practice, had patients like that?
Yes, I have. I've had some patients with amazingly large tumors that have ended up disease-free. And while not all of them have ended up being disease-free permanently, I believe that their survival has been positively impacted by hepatic resection. One can always ask the question, is there ever a role for serial non-curative surgery in the management of patients with colorectal cancer? And I have to admit that there was a patient advocate in Canada who I crossed paths with, who subsequently has died of her disease, but who had recurrent colon cancer managed surgically more than medically over a period of about 8 years.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Think Tank edition of Colorectal Cancer Update.